Iran's parliament overwhelmingly approves a bill that urges the government to increase uranium enrichment to 20% in response to anti-Tehran sanctions. OPEC members reach a broad consensus on the need to extend oil production cuts for 3 months if their allies also support such a move. And U.S. President Donald Trump faces another setback as the states of Wisconsin and Arizona certify Joe Biden as the winner of the November presidential vote. Thanks for joining us. Iranian lawmakers have overwhelmingly approved a bill aimed at tackling sanctions imposed on the country. The bill requires the government to pursue uranium enrichment of 20%. It also calls for increasing stockpiles of low-enriched uranium. The bill calls for making use of advanced centrifuges, namely IR-6 and IR-2M types. Iranian lawmakers pushed for the bill following multiple rounds of sanctions that the U.S. imposed after it withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. Iran had agreed to curbs on its nuclear program. The bill follows the Friday assassination of eminent Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The bill is Iran's first practical response to the assassination, and that more steps will follow. Iran has once again vowed to bring to justice those behind the assassination of its top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The foreign ministry spokesman said that Iran will certainly punish the perpetrators of the targeted killing, as well as those who ordered it. Saeed Khatibzadeh added that Israel's role in the terror attack with the support of the U.S. is undeniable. Fakhrizadeh was assassinated in a town near the capital Tehran on Friday. The foreign ministry spokesman thanked all governments who slammed the assassination, including Iran's Arab neighbors. Khatibzadeh said that only one Persian Gulf state did not condemn the assault. He was referring to Saudi Arabia. The EU describes the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as a criminal act, but stops short of pointing the finger at Israel for the atrocity. Jerome Hughes reports.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaz is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights on which or for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States. But also, trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder? And what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal?
Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Members of the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries have agreed to extend oil production cuts for another 3 months starting from January. OPEC ministers and delegates said that there would be consensus on the issue if their allies in a wide group called OPEC Plus support the move. Iranian oil minister Bijan Zangane also confirmed the consensus but said that the meeting with OPEC Plus would be difficult, requiring negotiations and patience. Sources said Tuesday's meeting has been rescheduled to December the 3rd to give more time for discussions. In April, OPEC members agreed to cut production by 7.7 million barrels a day due to diminishing demand amid the coronavirus pandemic, but OPEC Plus countries want the output to be increased. The U.S. states of Arizona and Wisconsin have certified the victory of Joe Biden in the November 3rd presidential election. In a statement, Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers said that he has signed a certificate of ascertainment for Biden and his running mate Kamala Harris. The Arizona Secretary of State Katie Hobbs also finalized Biden as the winner after a recount. She also slammed all baseless allegations against the state's voting process. The certifications are yet another blow to President Donald Trump, who has refused to concede the election, claiming that the vote was rigged in favor of his Democratic rival. Trump's campaign has also requested a new recount of votes in Georgia, which is due to end of December 2nd. Several states have already certified Biden's victory. Earlier, we were joined by a correspondent in Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell. He says President Trump will not concede defeat anytime soon, despite the fact that Arizona and Wisconsin have certified Biden as the winner.
We have a president who we know is fed a lot by his ego and just what he can get out of a deal, what he could get out of a certain situation. And right now, he's still getting the adulation and the attention from his supporters. We have to remember that even though the president lost the election in the Electoral College and in the popular vote, he still had more than 70 million Americans who voted for him. And he's trying to leverage this amount of Americans, these votes, into something for the future, whether it's a run in 2024, which has been speculated, or whether it's a television network where he would have some devoted fans, or if there was some other type of lucrative financial deal that he could get by keeping alliances with some of the Republicans in Congress. That's what he intends to do. And at the very least, he wants to try to overturn this election, right? If possible, if he could see that there's a way around it. But, like you said before, with the two states certifying their votes, two swing states, two major battleground states, Arizona and Wisconsin, it really seals the fate of the president trying to overturn the election. That doesn't mean that he's still going to, he's going to stop trying.
U.S. President Donald Trump's coronavirus pandemic advisor, Scott Atlas, has resigned after downplaying the threat of the disease for months. In his resignation letter obtained by the media, Atlas thanked Trump for the honor while wishing all the best to the next U.S. administration. Atlas was selected by Trump to advise him on the pandemic despite having no expertise in infectious diseases or epidemiology. He joined the White House this summer, where he clashed with top scientists and health experts, including Dr. Anthony Fauci. He was accused of providing Trump with incorrect COVID-related information. He was also at the heart of controversy over his comments against mask wearing. So far, the U.S. is the worst-hit country, with nearly 13.5 million infections and almost 268,000 deaths. The U.S. Senate remains divided on an aid plan for the pandemic-hit economy ahead of a year-end deadline. Lawmakers have urged their Senate colleagues to reach a deal as time is running out. Both Republicans and Democrats in the Senate have acknowledged the urgency of clinching a deal, but they remain divided on how much to spend and what to spend it on. The deadlock comes despite months of negotiations. Both sides blame each other. The U.S. Congress in March approved a $2.2 trillion aid package, but a number of its key provisions will expire at the end of the year. The head of the World Health Organization has warned about a rising trend of coronavirus infections in Mexico.
The number of increase in cases and deaths in Mexico is very, very worrisome. When it reached its lowest the week of October 12, it was around 2,000. Now by November 23, the week of November 23, the number of deaths has doubled from 2,000 to around 4,000. I think this shows that Mexico is in bad shape.
Tedros says the number of deaths and infections has surged in Mexico, indicating that the country is facing a serious problem. Mexico's coronavirus death toll is the fourth highest in the world and has crossed the grim milestone of 100,000. Confirmed cases are around 1.1 million. Experts say the figures are probably much higher. Officials say that most of the hospital beds are occupied by COVID-19 patients. The UN says 1 in 33 people around the world will need humanitarian aid next year due to the coronavirus pandemic. According to UN officials, the figure will amount to 235 million people worldwide. They say that that's a 40% increase from the number of people in need of aid in 2020. The UN says hunger, conflicts, and climate change have made the situation worse. Says that there's also a risk of famines in countries like Syria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Yemen. The UN is appealing for more funding by wealthier countries. It says it has raised only half of the $35 billion funding required to reach out to those in need. Since the coronavirus hit France nearly 1 year ago, and with the second lockdown of 6 months, unemployment and poverty are rising dramatically in the European country. Kristen Hunt has more.
A new kind of the French population is falling into a state of poverty. That's the conclusion of a poll institute, Ipsos, the Observatory of Inequalities, and of important humanitarian associations like the Resto du Coeur and Secours Populaire. They sound the alarm. The health crisis caused by the coronavirus is provoking an unprecedented social crisis. A new kind of people stand in line today for clothes and food assistance.
More and more people are coming here, especially since 3 weeks, because it's getting cold. We have started distribution points for women and older people, and we see that more women and older persons are coming. Now we have also more and more young people, young mothers, and students, so there is more diversity in the people coming here.
Rachid Agar is the founder and responsible of this Open Table Humanitarian Association. Since long time, he is heavily invested in aid for people in need.
Those who had small jobs of 2 or 3 hours a day, they sunk. Everybody is at the bottom. We picked up many of them. They were on a tightrope and they tipped over. We see a lot of them.
1 in 3 French persons has now less income than before the COVID crisis. Those who still have work fear to lose their job. Mariette was a saleswoman. Her business closed during the first lockdown. Now she depends from the food distribution. She crossed the line.
These people emptied their savings. They consumed the last tin can before coming here to us. At the end, when they had nothing left, they came here and stood in line. We notice people who come here for the first time. The misery today is screaming. We hear it. Hunger is yelling. Before, hunger and the misery were silent and hidden. Today, people are not ashamed anymore because they are in a survival mode.
The number of persons who receive food aid increased with 30% since the COVID crisis. Old people are paying a heavy tribute in matter of health, but young people will suffer more from the economic impact of the COVID crisis. Half of the poor in France is less than 30 years old. Since the beginning of the COVID crisis and the 2 lockdowns, 1 extra million of French has fallen under the poverty line. That's a total of 10 million of poor people in France. The Bank of France foresees an unemployment rate over 10% for 2021. An increasing number of people are in need for food assistance and blankets, especially now in the freezing cold. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Azerbaijani forces have moved into the final district given up by Armenia in a peace deal that ended weeks of fighting over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Azerbaijan's defense ministry released a video showing a tank leading a column of trucks into the Lechin district. The trucks were flanked by military vehicles from Russia, which brokered the peace deal. Under the accord, Armenia agreed to hand over to Azerbaijan 3 districts. The deal also saw some 2,000 Russian peacekeepers deployed in Nagorno-Karabakh. The agreement was reached on November 9. It ended 6 weeks of fighting between Azerbaijan and Armenia over Nagorno-Karabakh. The fighting was the deadliest in a decades-long dispute over the region. The British government says businesses should get ready for the end of the Brexit transition period amid deadlocked talks over a trade deal with the European Union. Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove says that there's no time to lose for companies, only 1 month to go before the current trade agreements expire. He had earlier warned of potential disruptions for businesses due to an increase in red tape, regardless of the results of the talks with the EU. Britain formally left the bloc in January, but remains bound by EU rules by the end of 2020. That is when the transition period ends. The two sides should reach a deal on their future trade ties, but they have remained deadlocked over a number of issues. Palestinians have held a protest rally in a village of West Bank against Israel's decision to raise it to the ground. The rally was part of events to mark the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Mona Kandil has more from occupied West Bank.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed at drawing attention to the struggle of the Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands.
This year, however, Palestinians say they were left alone struggling the Israeli occupation and its non-stop attempts to annex more lands, mainly after some Arab states have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv. These ties, Palestinians say, simply undermine efforts for Palestinian state. Palestinian officials stress that what they see as a symbolic international solidarity has failed to give the Palestinian people their rights, while Israel continues to occupy most of the land of historical Palestine.
Israel will not be deterred by statements of condemnation. Israel can be stopped only by popular nonviolent Palestinian struggle and boycott, divestment, sanctions against its system of apartheid. That's what we want to see. BDS, not normalization with occupation.
The UN, meanwhile, has renewed commitment to the Palestinian people. However, its Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has cautioned that the prospects for a viable two-state solution are becoming more distant, mainly with Israel's expansion of illegal settlements, a significant spike in the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, violence, and continued militant activity. After more than 40 years since the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the UN, Palestinian rights remain usurped and the dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
The 16th edition of Resistance International Film Festival has seen its award ceremony in Tehran. Due to the coronavirus outbreak, the event was held without mass gathering. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Human strivings for freedom. This theme takes center stage in the second round of the 16th Resistance International Film Festival. This year, the cinematic event was held without the presence of viewers due to the coronavirus, and the award ceremony was broadcast live through online streaming platforms.
Despite the fact that the festival was held without physical participation of viewers and spectators, there was a remarkable participation, especially by foreign filmmakers. This year, we have not categorized the festival into national and international sectors. In fact, it was international in all of its sections.
Over 10,000 films from 180 countries competed in the cinematic event, which was held in two rounds. The first round, which was held 2 months ago, was themed with the fight against the coronavirus. The second round is themed with human suffering under imposed wars and the resistance against inhumanities. Laureates find the festival an opportunity to shine out for any filmmaker who has concerns about peace and freedom.
Resistance Film Festival is a major cinematic event. It can be a turning point for both Iranian and foreign filmmakers because their films compete against the professional works by renowned filmmakers who have a rich experience in producing films about resistance and peace.
The best film in absolute sense is one of the interesting sections of the festival. The award in this section went to Abbas Imanian for his short documentary, A Letter from Damascus. The film narrates the story of Abbas, an newlywed Iranian man who set south for Syria to join the resistance forces and fight Daesh terrorists there. He will lose his life. The tragic story is recounted through the love letters Abbas had written and sent to his wife in Iran.
Resistance Film Festival uses the medium of film as a powerful means to portray the concerns of those who live in war zones and to relay this message to world leaders that political interests cannot be traded with human lives. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را دستورتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, we discussed Imam Khomeini's style of teaching in brief. We said that he was very humble in hearing to the criticism of his students and also encouraged them to have a critical spirit rather than accepting what is taught very easily. However, he would never let anyone waste the time of the class for trivial and lengthy debates. It is vital for teaching to have three features to be effective. First, teaching should be based on a specific aim. The teacher should know what he is seeking and where he wants to reach. Secondly, there should be a reciprocal relation between the teacher and the student. Unilateral teaching and monologue is rarely effective and fruitful. The student should be involved in the course of teaching. Thirdly, the teacher should provide easy and suitable opportunities for learning to enable the student to learn the material in the easiest way. Experts of education have divided teaching's techniques into four categories. The first technique is teaching based on direct conveying of information. The second technique is based on interaction and involvement. The third one is problem-oriented, and the fourth one is individual teaching. Although it is not simple to refer one of these techniques over others, experts maintain that the interactive technique is the best and most successful method. The interactive technique is characterized by active teaching. In this method, the activity of the learner or student is highly emphasized. This is why it is also called active method technique. In other words, the student has a very active role in class. He or she participates in discussions and raises his or her view on various issues, trying to solve problems. He or she gathers experiences from the teacher and is guided by the teacher. The teacher does not behave as a superior authority, but as a guide and director. This method leads to thriving of creativity and talents of students rather than bringing up lethargic and passive students. Imam Khomeini's method of teaching was very active and discussion-oriented. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat said, "When the Imam raised an issue for discussion, both Arab and non-Arab ulema would come. Imam Khomeini would let them debate. Some would say that he hadn't had this method in Qom and had started it in Najaf. He would allow debates in public sessions. Sometimes the Imam himself would participate in the discussion so that even students like me could debate with him. But if there was a debate among friends, he would keep silent and listen unless when his opinion was asked. Then he would participate in the debate. His method was quite honorable and vital for us."
Thank you.
Dear listeners, one of the factors that making classes non-interactive is the scientific vanity of the teacher. Scientific vanity prevents active participation of students in scientific debates and blocks the way of progress. According to all of his classmates and students, Imam Khomeini was devoid of any scientific vanity, and this had made his classes the most active classes among seminaries. Ayatollah Qadiri says, "The Imam would show no negative reaction to good words. He was never seen to have scientific vanity towards his knowledge. He would say, maybe this is correct, maybe that is correct." Late Ayatollah Abdul Karim Musavi Ardabili said, "Imam Khomeini never had scientific vanity. In his books, he would not use phrases or words to denote that he had plunged in scientific vanity to have the connotation that nobody could understand as much as he could." Dear friends, Imam Khomeini was a good listener to the audience of his words, especially those who would object his words and writings. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Zanjani said, "Anyone who talked at the Imam's class, even the young students who were raising an objection, the Imam would give them opportunity and would listen to them. This would train the students in this way. I have seen this characteristic in Imam Khomeini's class and even his ordinary dealings. When someone wanted to tell him something, he would listen to him exactly and with full attention." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, used to teach in a way to bring up his students self-confident. Ayatollah Mazahiri says, "The Prophet of Islam would behave with his companions in a way that each of them thought that he was the dearest for him. Imam Khomeini was like this in his teaching. He would regard his students with high esteem so that their talents would flourish. He would accept a good word and thank for it." Ayatollah Mubahedi Kermani says, "Imam Khomeini taught in Masjid-e-Azam, that is the great mosque in Qom. At the end of the class, he would sit for a while and people would gather around him. I raised the objection that I had in my mind. The Imam was silent for a short while. Then he said, I have to think. This is very humble. In these cases, professors usually give an answer immediately so that their scientific status is not hurt before the student. But the Imam showed humbleness and said, I have to think." Dear listeners, next time we will continue this discussion.
The debate.
When it comes to the issue of human rights in Saudi Arabia, it's a well-known fact that there is minimal existence of this in the kingdom. Opposition is not only condemned, but could consist of jail time. The regime is back in the spotlight, with the continued detention of at least 5 women's rights activists. In this edition of the debate, we will look at the abysmal human rights record in Saudi Arabia, and how member countries of the so-called international community continue their dealings with Saudi Arabia, one of their initiatives being economic gains.
7 out of the 9 European countries which have appointed human rights ambassadors have criticized the continued detention of women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia. In a statement, the ambassadors of the UK, the Netherlands, Germany, Sweden, Estonia, Luxembourg and Finland
call for the release of all political detainees in Saudi Arabia.
We remain deeply concerned by the continued detention of at least 5 women rights activists in Saudi Arabia. Peaceful activism and advocating for women's rights is not a crime. We join the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, special rapporteurs and treaty bodies in reiterating our call for the release of all political detainees, including women's rights activists.
The envoy especially drew attention to the cases of 2 activists, Lujain Al-Hathloul and Samar Badawi. Hathloul was put on trial last Wednesday after 900 days in prison, but her case was transferred to the Specialized Criminal Court. That's the institution that Amnesty International says is used to, quote, silence dissent. She is charged with attempting to destabilize the kingdom for defying Riyadh's ban on women's driving 1 month before it was officially lifted in June 2018. The case of Badawi, who had also campaigned against a driving ban, was earlier sent to the same court. Along with the European Human Rights Envoys, Chairman of the US House Intelligence Committee Adam Schiff has also called for the immediate release of the activists. But both the Europeans and the US have so far only paid lip service to the Saudi suppression of dissent and other gross human rights violations. Saudis have a long list of violations of human rights. They have led a deadly crackdown on the decade-long uprising in the oil-rich and Shia-majority eastern province, especially in Qatif region, where protesters seek an end to discrimination and political marginalization. That's beside what Human Rights Watch calls infringement on freedom of expression, association and belief, as well as migrant workers' rights. Riyadh has also helped Bahrain quash the 2011 uprising for democracy, supported an armed Takfiri terrorist in Syria, and has been leading a bloody war of aggression on Yemen, which has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children. But silence has been Western countries' reaction to Riyadh's role in Bahrain and Syria. And in Yemen, the West has encouraged and supported the Saudis by continuing to sell the kingdom the arms it uses to kill civilians. These are besides sweeping the Jamal Khashoggi case under the rug after the US Central Intelligence and the UN clearly linked his murder to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Riyadh appears to have carte blanche on abusing human rights, which limits Western reactions to his crimes to occasionally strongly worded statements. Actions, however, remain lacking thanks to Europeans and the US's lucrative trade deals with Saudi Arabia.
Joining us for this edition of The Debate, journalist and author Daniel Lazar joins us from New York. We have author and academic Lawrence Davidson joining us from Westchester. I'd like to welcome you both. Lawrence Davidson, I'm going to first start with you and just pretty much ask you a very, very simple question. Saudi Arabia, human rights, what comes to your mind immediately?
Well, what comes to my mind is a dictatorship that uses religion as a cover, and the economic resources it has to essentially buy the silence of everybody else. There's other things that are going on here, and it's not only the economic deals that you've mentioned in the introduction. There's a reluctance on the part of the international community, which is a nation-based community, to seriously interfere in what they consider to be the internal affairs of other countries. And this is an age-old principle. It started to break down after the Second World War. And the example we got with the Holocaust and the Stalinist concentration camps that he ran in the West, and so that started to deteriorate. But now it's back. So the reluctance to have anyone interfere in another country's what is considered their internal affairs is something that holds back these countries from going beyond strong statements. And it's also what underlies vetoes, often vetoes in the Security Council and that sort of thing. So it's got a history to it.
Okay, the reason why we have this topic for this debate, Daniel Azar, is the case of five women, which has been highlighted, especially with these five European countries, for example, who are deeply concerned about their detention, because right now they've been referred to the Special Criminal Court for terrorism and national security. One of them is this lady by the name of Hathloui, who was targeted because of a law barring women from driving, which later, obviously, that law was annulled. So tell us what you think that somebody was detained for that is now in a court, a special criminal court for terrorism and national security.
Well, I mean, Saudi Arabia is quite simply the most undemocratic country on the face of the earth, and that includes us, North Korea, other terrifying dictatorships, but Saudi Arabia is in a class by itself. First of all, the country is wholly owned by the Al Saud, the House of Saud. It's really their private property. They treat it as their private property. They monopolize political power, and they simply do not grant the slightest rights to other people who live there. In the case of this woman who was arrested, it's a classic example of what happened in Saudi Arabia. Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, knew he had to loosen the regulations banning women from driving for purely international reasons. He did so, but at the same time, he clamped down on women agitating for that right from within, because he can't tolerate any kind of challenge to his authority, no matter how mild, no matter how circumspect, even if he agrees with what the challengers are calling for. So it's a total dictatorship, a total crackdown, and one which allows for absolutely no free expression by individuals outside the royal family. And even within the royal family, I might add, there's a reign of terror that prevents any kind of criticism of Mohammed bin Salman or his father, King Salman.
Well, Lawrence Davidson, you mentioned economic gains here. I'm looking at the fact that you have these five European countries that have come out and made these statements. But what is the checklist when it comes to dealing with Saudi Arabia? I mean, when these countries like the U.S., like the U.K. or France, take a look at this checklist when it comes to the issue of human rights, well, they're going to go down and see, well, you know, people are being put in jail, there are sham trials. Oh, and there's a war that they're killing people in Yemen, for example, and yet they're dealing with them. They're dealing with the Saudi regime, going to the G20, giving them, again, another stamp of approval, of acceptance in the business community, per se. So that kind of sounds like double standards when it comes to the so-called international community.
Oh, absolutely. And if you're looking for morality in international affairs, it's not there in any driving or practical way. After the Second World War, lip service was paid. It was thought required to be paid to human rights because of the horrors of the Holocaust and other genocides that were coming down the line and all this sort of thing. So you had the international community, particularly Western countries, taking a verbal stand against that. But when it comes to diplomatic relations, when it comes to economic profit, all of these countries, one way or another, they have internal important companies that are making money off of Saudi Arabia. And so they feel that they have to maintain that double standard. And again, it's the history of international relations that in fact you do not bring morality into it in any serious way. Here in the United States, there's been a long-standing debate between idealists and realists. Realists are those who, you know, want to dispense with morality when it comes to international relations, and they generally have won the argument. And so it's not a surprise. And I don't think it's going to change under Biden, certainly. And this is the way it is until we can resurrect some sort of, you know, morality, standards of morality for international relationships. International law seems presently dead in the water.
Well, there was almost a total embrace when it came to Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince Daniel Azar, when he introduced his reform agenda. I mean, you have headlines like the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, power behind the throne. And then there was a shakedown that happens where you had all these wealthy businessmen, some of them princes, at the Ritz-Carlton, alongside people being jailed. And then you had the assassination of Khashoggi, which was in the worst way with the dismemberment, etc. So what happened to the reform agenda? I mean, you know, when we talk about the way that Saudi Arabia is still being embraced, whilst it has committed these atrocious crimes that are in the human rights arena, it's basically giving it a stamp of approval to continue dealing with it.
Yes, you've got to bear in mind that not only is Saudi Arabia the most undemocratic country in the face of the earth, it's also the sick man of the Middle East. Its political institutions are in disarray. Its economy is a wreck thanks to the fall in oil prices. MBS's attempts to diversify the economy have gone nowhere. And the reign of terror that MBS is conducting will eventually backfire and will eventually lead to his own doing. He's a dictator isolated in his palace. He's surrounded by enemies on all sides. It's only a matter of time before he falls. And if he falls, there will be chaos. So that's what the Western countries, the so-called Western democracies, are trying to prevent. They're trying to uphold the Saudi regime by all means possible. And so if Mohammed bin Salman, you know, makes some kind of gesture towards reform, the U.S., Britain, France, etc., all cheer wildly, all in the hope that there's somehow this story will have a happy ending. But it won't. The regime can only crash and burn. It's profoundly unstable. Its days are numbered. We don't know how long it'll last. It could be days, could be years, could conceivably be even longer. But the handwriting is on the wall. This is a regime slated for self-destruction.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Lawrence Davidson, about an issue that many are not aware of, and that is the suppression that happens in the eastern Qatif region where the Shia minority actually live. And we need to talk about that because these people are being suppressed. And also, at the same time, we can compare that, the suppression, to what's happening to the Shias in Bahrain. So here you have these two brothers, namely Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, suppressing the Shia population in their countries. What's your take on that?
Well, these particular dictators, both in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, have been raised within the Sunni Muslim sect to see Shiites as dangerous, as heretics, and this sort of thing. And now in Saudi Arabia, you've got this sort of weird kind of situation where it's Shiites who work in the oil fields in the east, and so they're constantly under observation and suspect. So essentially, because the Sunni rulers expect or see the Shiites as dangerous and heretical, they expect an uprising, And so they suppress them and create the conditions for an uprising. It doesn't, you know, it's not an indication that these guys are thinking things through. But it's an ideologically driven kind of hatred that they have. And so it's not surprising that the suppression of the Shiites in Saudi Arabia is a longstanding. It's not new. And periodically, the Shiites react in stronger ways or less stronger ways, but it's ongoing. And it's certainly not surprising that the Saudis intervened to support the Sunni minority regime in Bahrain. So in both cases, they saw it in their international, they see this in terms of their internal interests to maintain their own dictatorship.
Daniel Azar, another thing that Saudi Arabia has been really critiqued for is this Sharia law, but not that the Sharia, the way that Sharia is practiced. Not that Sharia in Muslim countries that practice it is something that's bad, but because a distorted version of it has been adopted by one of the worst entities that actually spelled danger for much of the world, and that was for the Daesh terrorists, who adopted this type of ideology in their own warped way. And many said that perhaps that emanated from Saudi Arabia. Do you see that being, that Saudi Arabia is guilty somewhat of that?
Oh, of course. I mean, listen, since 1979, the takeover of the Grand Mosque in Mecca, the Saudi royal family has been determined to burnish its credentials, its Islamic credentials, by exporting its own brand of Islam, which is a brand known as Wahhabism, which is extremely harsh, extremely intolerant, and which enforces a very unforgiving form of Sharia. So what we've seen throughout the Sunni world since 1979 has been the Wahhabization of the Sunni world. This is evident from Indonesia to the suburbs of Paris. And this has had a dramatic effect, and it's wreaked havoc both within the global Muslim community and also in terms of that community's relations with the outside world. It's promoted a very xenophobic, inward-looking, anti-modernist point of view, which has been disastrous for Muslims first and foremost. And of course, it's also driven the conflict with Iran. Bear in mind, anti-Shiism goes to the heart of the Saudi regime. In 1803, I believe it was, the al-Saud launched an attack on, I believe it was Karbala, in which thousands of Shiites were killed. And so this strain of belief goes way back as far as the regime is concerned. And so the al-Saud, the royal family, has placed itself at the disposal of the United States, which has used them as kind of their Praetorian guard to police the Middle East and impose a kind of Wahhabist conformity throughout the Middle East in order to marshal opposition to Iran and its allies.
And finally, my question to you, Lawrence Davidson, you said that the incoming administration, if confirmed, once confirmed in the U.S., is going to carry on as business as usual. Why do you say that? You don't think there will be a change in the way that it approaches Saudi Arabia, especially when it comes to things like the war in Yemen?
Yeah, well, my position on this is that economic relations with Saudi Arabia will continue as usual. It's much too lucrative for the U.S. economy, which isn't in very good shape, to not do that. So Biden will continue his relationship with Saudi Arabia, particularly in terms of economics. Now, with a proper amount of pushing on the part of the more progressive elements and maybe some of the people that he's actually bringing into the State Department and the NSA and what have you, we might be able to push him to withdraw U.S. support, active support, for the war in Yemen. There might be still U.S. naval ships in the area that help it in the blockade and what have you. It's likely that we can encourage Biden to remove that kind of support for the Saudi war in Yemen, but there will be no breakage of economic or diplomatic relations and this sort of thing, unless the Saudi prince oversteps his bounds. The killing of the journalist, which happened in another country, albeit in a Saudi embassy, but still, it happened in another country, in Turkey. And Khashoggi was an American, had an American green card. And so that kind of behavior comes very close to overstepping the bounds and requiring some sort of reaction. Now, he got away with that, at least with the Americans this time. If he tries that again, or if there's repeated examples of that, then he's going to get into trouble in the international environment.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, unfortunately, I have to end it. We're fresh out of time. Journalist and author Daniel Lazar, thank you for your comments, and author and academic Lawrence Davidson there with his comments. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From me, Cover Town, for the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. And I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the reality of unity and divine justice. The principle of God's existence is clear and manifest for us, and any particle from particles of this world points to His dignity, power, knowledge, and ability. On the other hand, the reality of His existence is hidden from us because He is an infinite existence and beyond our understanding. So we should consider His essence to be beyond whatsoever we may imagine. And this is the reality of unity. Events occur in the world whose underlying mystery is not always known to us. Belief in God's justice says to us that all of these events are backed by sound reasons, and any suspicion in this regard is not in conformity with belief in His justice and wisdom. So, We think that we know our Creator. We think that we have the ma'rifah of our Creator, the in-depth recognition of our Creator. Well, no, that unity is not that simple for us to understand. Not that it cannot be understood at all. No, it can. But we need to know that our intellect has limitations, whereas the existence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is unlimited. So the limited being, which is our intellect, cannot really comprehend the infinite being, which is the existence of Allah. That said, we still can attain a good level of understanding and recognition of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is expected from all of us. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the reality of unity of Allah and His divine justice. Well, Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, reality of unity of Allah indicates that one shall not define his essence according to one's imaginations, and belief in his justice infers that one shall not accuse him in any work. Brothers and sisters, can the human mind comprehend the reality of Allah's essence? Does the human brain possess the ability to fathom the reality of Allah's essence? Well, Allah's essence is beyond whatsoever we may imagine, and this is the reality of unity. Accusing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in any form and shape implies that His wisdom and justice is being challenged, and hence, once we accept that He is the One and we consider His actions to be perfect, there is no room left for any disobedience. So I know it's a little heavy concept for us to digest, but understand and realize this, that Allah is just, Allah is wise, Allah doesn't do any oppression. Once we get to the logical proof of these concepts, there is no room left for anyone to challenge Allah's authority, Allah's justice. Okay? These need to be proven first, and once we get to the proof of these concepts, we understand that Allah is the only just being. He is the Adil, Adil Mutlaq, right? So this is what the message of today's lesson was. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Reporters.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed to